From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Father Daniel Berrigan. His new autobiography, To Dwell in Peace, is a record of his decades at the forefront of the peace movement and the Catholic left. Also today, I speak with the composer who does the music for all of Spike Lee's films, his father, Bill Lee. Our jazz critic Evan Whitehead reviews the latest album from saxophonist Henry Threadgill and his sextet. And television critic David Bianculli examines the thinking behind TV show theme songs. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Daniel Berrigan is a Jesuit priest, a political activist, and a leading figure in the Catholic left. He and his brother Philip Berrigan were the first Roman Catholic priests to receive federal sentences in America for anti-war activism. That was during the war in Vietnam. The Berrigans both committed acts of civil disobedience, briefly went underground, and served time in prison. Since the war in Vietnam, the Berrigans have continued their anti-war activism. In 1980, they were part of the Plowshares 8, a group which committed civil disobedience by entering a General Electric re-entry division assembly site in Pennsylvania. They damaged the nose cones of two nuclear warheads with hammers, then poured their blood on blueprints and tools. They were convicted and are now appealing the case. Although Daniel Berrigan is still considered something of a renegade within the church, he remains a Jesuit and lives in a small Jesuit community in Manhattan. He now works at an AIDS hospice in Greenwich Village, ministering to the terminally ill. Daniel Berrigan has written a new autobiography titled To Dwell in Peace. I spoke with him from the NPR Bureau in New York. In his new book, he tells how he hated Catholic school. He thought of it as a theater of cruelty. I asked Berrigan why he went on to pursue a religious life.
I was very taken by the idea of community, and also I love books and study and teaching, and it seemed as though the Jesuits had all those requirements, and it was very, very fortunate I went ahead with that. I think it's been good for me and good for them too.
You've described yourself as a late bloomer. And you describe yourself being ill and in the hospital when America dropped the atom bomb on Hiroshima and reading about it in the newspaper and that being somehow a pivotal point in your life.
I think it was, even though, of course, at the time I couldn't realize where it was going to take me. But I just had a dreadful feeling, almost as though that bomb had gone off within me. And I think knew obscurely at that point that this was going to blast a lot of suppositions that I had had about what we might call normal living or normal priesthood or normal Jesuit. And that all came true.
Well, when that first happened, when you first read about it and you had this feeling that things were going to change in the world and in your life and in how you interpreted your calling, what came next? What was the first change in your life that followed through on that?
Well, I think, as I said, I was a long time trudging through all this and coming to realize something practical rather than something theoretical about it. Mm-hmm. That is to say, it wasn't going to be enough just to stand around and wring one's hands at the enormous changes in the world, the enormous escalation of possible violence. But I had to get through all this business of the course of studies. And when I began teaching in 1946, I tried to introduce the question to classes that I told about in the book there, and found these young people extremely belligerent and pretty well immersed in the Second World War, probably through their homes, but also through the church, and very difficult to break through with the idea that something horrid had happened and something more horrid was on the horizon, and that we'd better look at it, you know. That was very sobering to realize that people much younger than myself were so warlike.
1965 was a real turning point in your life, and in your brother's life as well. Your brother Philip Berrigan was expelled from the seminary, I believe it was, and he was assigned to a parish in inner city Baltimore.
Right.
That same year, you were basically exiled to Latin America for your objections to the war in Vietnam. What were your early protests like back in 1965 and before?
Well, it was all kind of pale. I joined Catholic workers here in New York at a vigil and a blockage of the U.S. mission to the U.N. I had heard, someone called me and said that the police were brutalizing people who were sitting in there in front of the entrance in objection to the war. And I went down and indeed found that they were doing that. They were stepping on people very deliberately. There was a lot of official malice in the air. And I went down there in my clerical outfit and dog collar, and the whole thing stopped when they saw a priest. They stepped gingerly aside and didn't want to be found in that position before their church. And that was a very interesting lesson. Though I didn't at that point sit down, I was just too kind of naive or raw to realize that I should have been right there blocking. Anyway, it went on, and then I joined some students at the Pentagon in 67, and that was my first arrest. I went down there just to support them and then found that I had to join them. That was very good.
That must have given you a sense of the power you could have, that first demonstration when they saw your priestly garments, and things changed when they saw you.
Well, you know, that sort of thing, of course, is cut both ways as things developed in the church, because especially in the later years of the war, I found that Catholics became my toughest congregation or audience of all, and I always knew I was going to have a very rough time appearing in front of them, and that the frenzy of just war was alive and kicking in the Catholic community. And so, as I say, it worked both ways.
Back in 65, when you and your brother were both reassigned because of your protests against the war, did that make you cynical about the Jesuits, about the church, realizing that you were in some way being punished for your actions for peace, actions you really believed in, and actions that for you followed right from the Bible and from your religious beliefs?
Yeah. No, I don't think I ever had time for cynicism. I can't remember a moment of it. It was a time of very, very deep sorrow and uprooting and a sense of loss and alienation in a way, I mean, physical and psychological. But I sort of had to gather myself and undergo a discipline on the road, which really came down to prayer and to curiosity about this extraordinary opportunity that, you know, it was like being thrown into the briar patch and finding that that was a very interesting setting. So I began to keep a diary, which was later published, and that was a great help. So I turned the whole thing around because I had never been to Latin America, and it was an extraordinary experience. I came back worse than ever.
I like the way you put that. Daniel Berrigan is my guest, and he's written an autobiography which is titled To Dwell in Peace. Now, your brother was the first of the two of you to engage in an action of civil disobedience. This was really one of the first acts of civil disobedience in the peace movement against the war in Vietnam.
Right.
It was a group that became known as the Baltimore Four. They poured blood on draft records in Baltimore. Did you consider participating in that action, that early action of civil disobedience?
As far as I can recall, the issue didn't come up, because if it had come up, I think I would have a much, much clearer recollection of, you know, why I would not have taken part. The question became a serious one for me only after that, towards 68, when we got together as the Catonsville Nine. I think, as far as I recall, Philip went ahead with that first action with three Baltimore friends without consulting me.
How close were you then? Which was the first of you to enter the priesthood?
Oh, I went in years and years before Philip. He went off to the Second World War and was a decorated officer in Europe. And only...
That's interesting, because you were in the seminary during World War II.
I was all in the seminary, hiding out.
Mm-hmm.
And Philip came home, and of course he'd undergone enormous changes. And we talked a great deal about his future. And he came to visit me a good deal. And he had thought seriously of coming in the Jesuits also, but then they wouldn't guarantee them. We're a very elitist, snooty group. They wouldn't guarantee him any shortage of training and studies, because he was older and college graduate and veteran. So he went in the Josephites, who ordained him in 5 years.
Mm-hmm. So let's get back to the Catonsville Nine, mm-hmm. which is an action that you and your brother both participated in. And would you describe what the action was?
Well, we went into a draft board in Catonsville, Maryland, in May of 1968. And two of the felons were repeaters, that Tom Lewis and Philip. And they had come out on bond and then organized this thing. It was an act of extraordinary courage to go through that again, because obviously they were undergoing double jeopardy. And we took the files, the A1 files, which were the files of the most endangered of the young people. They would be drafted first. And we took them out of the building very carefully because we didn't want to do a fire in a building. And we burned them in trash baskets in a parking lot outside, with homemade napalm, which was our symbol of the napalm being used on children and all sorts of people in Vietnam.
This was really a very radical act. What pushed you to actually breaking the law? Once you do that in a way, there's no turning back.
Yes, and I think we all realized at the time that our lives would never be the same again. Well, it was a combination of things. I think I had reached my limit. As Gandhi says, keeping the law as long as one conscientiously can and testing the limits of the law through all sorts of legal activity. And then, as he advises, when that point comes where this is making no sense and getting nowhere and the laws are manifestly unjust anyway, step over, which I did.
What was the reaction of the church and the reaction of your fellow Jesuits?
Well, it was extremely edgy. This was all terra incognita. It was no person land, and nobody had done a thing like this in the history of the American order, though, of course, Jesuits had been jailed and murdered all through our history. But it was a cultural explosion in the States because we had become, I think, extremely, safe people. And the real questions that I had learned elsewhere and had learned from history were not being raised here because we were safe and prosperous. And so it became a very moot question as to whether or not I could survive in the order. And I did by the skin of my teeth, and here I am.
Why do you think you did survive in the order? Why do you think that they never expelled you?
Well, there was quite an uproar in both directions. Officially, there was all sorts of stuff about, get rid of him. And then there was a great upsurge among the younger Jesuits that were sort of walking with the objectors to the war by then. And I think the officials began to realize that this would create a totally unwanted storm, that someone would be evicted for conscientious activity against a horrible war. So the whole thing stopped short, just short. And yes, that was it.
For your actions in the Catonsville Nine, you were given a 3-year jail sentence.
Mm-hmm.
But you went underground, as did, I think, most of the other members of that group.
Yes.
Now, from the way you describe it in your autobiography, you didn't necessarily plan to go underground. You make it sound as if it were really a spur-of-the-moment decision.
Well, I may have given a wrong impression there. I don't recall exactly how I treated it. We did have extensive, thoughtful meetings about this whole question. I forget who of the eight survivors of the nine first raised it. But it was not spur of the moment, really. It was very, very carefully considered and thought through. And as far as I recall, four of us decided to go underground and four submitted and went to jail.
Why did you choose to go underground?
Well, it was a terrible time, as probably you recall. The spring of 70, Nixon had invaded Cambodia. There were these days of rage all over the country. Kent State had occurred. There were killings of black students at Jackson State. The whole place was in great turmoil, and including Cornell, where I was teaching. And it just made no sense to me. It was just, we used the analogy at the time of somebody submitting to the jail as submitting before the draft. It was bowing before a totally illegitimate authority and giving up what you had first resisted. So we felt there was a certain moral continuity required here. Some of us felt that.
When you went underground, in a way, every time you stayed at somebody's house along the way, you were jeopardizing them because they could have come up under criminal charges for harboring you.
Well, some did. Some did.
How did that make you feel, knowing that for the actions that you had taken, you were jeopardizing people who were close to you and strangers who were willing to help you?
It just seemed to me that the war was not my question, it was our question.
Mm-hmm.
And that I hadn't created the question, I was trying to respond to it. And that what was required here was not some individual, you know, wandering around. What was required was a community of resistance, and I was helping to build that through these fine people. And that was important for them as well as for me, because the legal jeopardy should, in the nature of conscience, should have been shared.
You felt that in a way it kind of strengthened their commitment to the movement?
Absolutely.
By taking a stand and putting themselves at risk?
And I was not their white man's burden. I was their conscience inviting them a little further. So I looked on the whole thing very cool. As, you know, my undergoing this awful time, which was really wonderful too, was not the nature of a burden on them. It was in the nature of an opportunity.
How long were you underground?
I think it went, as far as I recall, from May until August of 70.
Did you have a lot of disguises?
I don't think there was any great effort. You know, the main thing was to travel sensibly and to keep reasonably out of sight. And again, to keep a discipline going, I did a lot of writing and made tapes and even preached once in a public church.
Well, no, I believe that the other three were captured.
They were captured
within a week
quickly.
Or something. Yeah,
yes.
And you stayed underground for months.
Right.
What was your secret? I mean, what were you able to do that they didn't do to maintain your to remain hidden for so long?
I think I learned from each one of them at the time of their capture that I learned what not to do, and such things, for instance, as using the phone and traveling publicly and all that sort of thing, you know, or staying in very obvious places or homes, families that were already being surveilled, things like that. One didn't do those things if one wanted to go on.
Did you realize eventually you'd be caught?
Oh, sure. Because I had many opportunities simply to leave the country and wash my hands of the whole thing, and that was not the point of this. The point was to extend one's sort of escape, knowing it was temporary, and meantime raising the bloody question of the war in ways that you couldn't have from jail.
You were captured by two FBI agents?
Well, there was a whole coven of them, disguised, if you can imagine it, as bird watchers on Block Island. The whole thing was so absurd. I mean, they're not really very smart, these people. They were in the midst of a nor'easter, a real gale, there in late August, and there they were in their slickers watching birds. There wasn't a bird for 100 miles, you know?
So you knew who they were? You figured that out?
Oh, right away, sure.
Let me ask you, when they were taking you in the car back to jail, did you try to talk with them about the war?
Well, there wasn't a great deal of opportunity. See, they brought me in a Coast Guard cutter from the island into Providence, and as I say, the seas were very stormy, and they were trying to protect me in the boat from any kind of physical harm. They didn't want any marks on me. And I say this storm was raging around us, and then they simply deposited me in a jail.
Well, I want to talk more with you about your life, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Daniel Berrigan, who's written a new autobiography. It's titled To Dwell in Peace. We'll take a short break, then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Daniel Berrigan is my guest. He's written a new autobiography titled To Dwell in Peace. Even when you were in jail after you were captured, you were very visible within the peace movement. You wrote letters from jail and, I believe, poems from jail that ended up getting published. So you still had an important voice in the movement, even though physically you weren't present, even though physically you were behind bars.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, you really became one of the stars of the peace movement. Now, what I'd like to know from you is, what do you think are the pros and cons of having almost celebrities within a political movement. I mean, I think it really became an issue in the 60s and early 70s because people really did take on not only leadership positions, but people became the media spokespeople for the issues.
Yes.
So what do you think are some of the pros and cons of becoming one of those very visible people within a movement?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me say that, first of all, it's been a very difficult question, personally, and one that has always made me sort of, you know, run for the woods. This whole business of transforming a kind of moral voice or ethical voice or peaceable voice into this pumped-up absurdity called celebrity. And I think I've been able to sort of, you know, run around it or run through it or run by it pretty well, pretty well. But on the other hand, one can't simply renounce one's, I don't know what, one's voice or one's talent or maybe for helping people interpret the truth or turn a corner.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's a very thin line that I walk, you know. And I'm very glad for my family and for my community of Jesuits in helping me keep a kind of a human size in all of this, you know.
You've written that being a Christian needs redefining in every age. Do you feel that in a way you're living in a different age now than you were in the 60s and that you've had to redefine your commitment as a Christian, redefine the needs around you?
Well, I think, you know, the question you put is one way of putting everything, you know, the whole question. I grew up in a culture, let's say a religious culture, and in a family in which war was taken for granted as part of the human condition and part of the church's condition. And four of my brothers fought in the Second World War. We nearly lost several of them. But that was taken for granted. You went off. You went off, and you fought, you died, and you killed, and the whole bloody litany went on. And the real before and after had to occur and is occurring, not just to me or my family or the Jesuits, but to any thoughtful person, it seems to me, across the world, is saying we're at a dead end. We're either going to get rid of all this trash, this lethal trash, or we're all going to go under. That necessarily has required enormous changes in the church, which, of course, during the Vietnam years was still lagging, way behind. We didn't hear anything official for 10 horrible years from the Catholic bishops. So what has occurred to me has occurred, it seems to me, to everybody except those who have, you know, just gone asleep and are sleepwalking in the world. And it really is something quite simple. We're being transformed from a war-making church to a peacemaking church, and that's almost a genetic change. I mean, it's terrific. I'm not saying or claiming that it's happening at large or that it's happening even to most Catholics, but it's happening where it was happening to nobody, including me, let's say 20 years ago.
Right now you're spending a lot of your time working with people who have AIDS.
Yes.
You're working in a New York hospital. What led you to that kind of work?
Well, I was working, excuse me, for about 5 years, beginning in the, let's say, around 80. I began working with the dying in a hospital in New York where we were taking only those who had no place to go, street people, addicts, alcoholics, destitute dying people. And then the AIDS epidemic began. New York really hit me about 4 years ago. And I said to myself, I think I better get with that. So I transferred to another hospital, St. Vincent's, where we have one of the pioneering hospice-type treatment centers in the country.
You know, I'm sure that a lot of the people that you're working with, since you are a religious man, ask you, how can God allow this epidemic to happen?
Yes.
How do you deal with questions like that?
Well, if I could just say this, I don't think that becomes, it's strange when I think about it, that that's the big question. The big question for many of the young people I work with, because I work mainly in the homosexual community.
Mm-hmm.
This is the hospitals in Greenwich Village, and we don't have many drug people, so it's one kind of AIDS person. the bitterest question and the one that really makes my work most difficult is the attitude of the hierarchy and the church toward gay people. And so I come in under kind of jeopardy as a priest of a church that is pretty rigid and is extending its disapproval even to the very ill. And these people die under that cloud. I try my best to relieve the cloud by my own compassion, my own sense of myself and of them, but it's very hard going.
So you're a link to spiritual thought, even though the church might not condone homosexuality. You will, and you will be there for them.
Absolutely, and very much on their terms, that is to say, any kind of physical service, of shopping or cleaning, or simply holding somebody, or more specifically, religious activity. Some people want to pray with you or want communion brought, but I just like to be there on their terms.
You know, there are political issues involved with AIDS, issues of funding, issues of...
Of course.
Even issues of whether, like, if someone who is gay is dying, they're not legally allowed to be married. So yeah. There's issues of wills and things like that. So there are, like, legal political issues. But for the disease itself, there's no one to take action against. You know what I mean? Like, for the disease itself, you can't blame the government. You can't blame any kind of authorities. It's a really different kind of issue than war.
Well, of course, that's a very large topic. It just seems to me that the government is to be held responsible for the niggardliness and the tardiness of its response to this whole thing. We're involved in a permanent war economy. And the only ones that are getting fat are the generals. And the AIDS people can take the leavings or the gleanings or what's left over from all of this, but they're not a main issue any more than the homeless of New York are. So in a sense, I feel that every human being, whether ill or well or gay or straight, if we are gifted with any kind of a conscience, we're all in the same boat. We're all on death row, or we're all condemned by these maniacs. And the boat is leaking, and the only thing we can do is row and bail and try to meet one another on a decent basis.
Well, we only have a few seconds left, but let me ask you very briefly, to describe the religious community that you live in now.
Well, I live in a series of apartments on the Upper West Side with about 20 of our seminarians who are in studies in the graduate schools around and our priests. We have all sorts of professional people in the community who are doing good work in New York and across the country, and teaching and counseling and working in welfare hotels and doing advocate law and medicine and earning our living and paying our rent and undergoing the heat of New York, even in the winter, if you know what I mean.
I do.
Yes. Right.
Well, I want to thank you so very much for talking with
us. Thank you. It's been great.
Thank you for your time.
Okay.
My guest has been Daniel Berrigan, and he's a Jesuit priest and a social activist. He's spent time in prison for his acts of civil disobedience. He now works at an AIDS hospice in New York. He's written an autobiography, which is titled To Dwell in Peace. To Dwell in Peace is published by Harper & Row. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with jazz critic Gary Giddens, whose latest book is about Charlie Parker. Giddens is also the founder of the American Jazz Orchestra, which is reviving important and neglected jazz compositions. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. If you've seen Spike Lee's film She's Gotta Have It, or his new film School Days, then you've heard the music of his father, jazz composer Bill Lee. Coming up, a talk with Bill Lee about his music and his own school days. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album by the Henry Threadgill Sextet. Kevin says the band can sound as intimate as a small combo or as powerful as a big band. And television critic David Bianculli plays some of his favorite TV themes and tells why he thinks they work. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. In Panama today, there has been a mixed response to a call for a general strike. Organizations opposed to military strongman General Manuel Noriega are trying to force him out of power. Tony Abergan reports from Panama City.
The strike started out slowly this morning, but by afternoon it seemed to be a partial success. In the downtown area, almost all shops and businesses were closed, but buses were running and shops in poorer areas were open. Owners of many factories paid workers in the morning and told them not to come back after lunch. In many places, it was more of a lockout than a strike, with owners, not workers, making the decision to close down. In the vital Panama Canal, union leaders urged workers to take sick leave. The government says the strike was only 40% successful, but opposition leaders say it was much more than that. And they say that protests will continue until Noriega is gone. No time limit has been set for the current strike, but already forces opposed to Noriega have had their strongest showing to date. Most observers expect the strike to continue for several days and then fade away. For National Public Radio, I'm Tony Avergan in Panama City.
On the eve of his trip to Europe for a NATO summit meeting, President Reagan today left a warning for members of Congress who will be debating another aid package for the Nicaraguan Contras while he's away. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Speaking to the American Legion Convention in Washington today, the president sent a message to lawmakers who are considering whether to vote for a Democratic-sponsored humanitarian aid plan for the rebels in Nicaragua. The message, in so many words, was that the Democratic package would not be enough.
Whatever package emerges from the Congress must include a provision for expedited procedures that would allow us to request additional military aid to the freedom fighters should the peace process breakdown.
Expedited procedures is legislative jargon for a quick vote. The president wants the option of requesting a quick vote on more military aid to the Contras if the peace process fails. The $30 million Democratic plan contains no such provision, while the Republican-sponsored $36 million proposal does. And the president left no doubt today as to which one he supports. I'm Brian Naylor at the White House.
United Nations Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar today urged the United States not to close the UN mission of the Palestine Liberation Organization in New York. At an emergency meeting of the General Assembly, Perez de Cuellar reminded the U.S. of its obligation to allow accredited PLO members to carry out their UN functions. The Justice Department ordered the mission closed under a new anti-terrorist law. The State Department has joined the UN in condemning the law as a violation of the 1947 UN Charter. The State Department today condemned the arrest of South African Anglican Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Tutu was arrested today, along with scores of clergymen, during a march through the streets of Cape Town. State Department spokeswoman Phyllis Oakley said the arrests are a further hindrance to peaceful objectives in South Africa.
The United States government strongly condemns the South African government's forceful repression of peaceful demonstrations by criminalizing and suppressing the exercise of basic political and human rights. The South African government is shutting off avenues for nonviolent change in South Africa.
Tutu was taken away by police as his group tried to deliver a petition to Parliament protesting a crackdown on black opposition groups. The largest body of marchers was sprayed by water cannons. At least 100 demonstrators plus 10 journalists were reported arrested. The Supreme Court agreed today to decide whether the Customs Service can require employees and job applicants to undergo drug tests. It will be the High Court's first ruling on the constitutionality of mandatory drug testing for public employees. The justices will hear a challenge to the Customs Service testing program by a federal workers' labor union. The union says taking urine samples violates employees' privacy rights. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 48 points to finish at 2071.62. You're listening to National Public Radio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Evan Whitehead has a review of the new album from Henry Threadgill and his sextet. Threadgill is a composer and saxophonist who came out of the Chicago Musicians Collective, the AACM, the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians. He first attracted attention as a member of the cooperative trio Air. Throughout the 80s, Threadgill has devoted most of his time to working with his versatile sextet.
In 1980, a new breed of jazz group began appearing on the scene. Units like David Murray's and John Carter's octets and Henry Threadgill's sextet. These medium-sized chameleons slither between small group and big band strategies, combining the agility of the former with the massed power of the latter. On record, saxophonist Henry Threadgill's sextet has proved the most consistently rewarding of these mid-sized bands. Their new album, their fifth, is Easily Slip Into Another World on RCA. This sextet, as everyone must keep pointing out, is really a seven-piece band with double drummers Feronok Loff and Reggie Nicholson, two brass players, trumpeter Razul Sadiq and the versatile Frank Lacey, and the dual strings of cellist Deidre Murray and bassist Fred Hopkins. If the success of mid-sized groups rests on their ability to synthesize big and small band traditions, Threadgill takes his syntheses further than that. Perhaps more than any other current jazz composer, he mixes strains from every phase in the music's history. Threadgill echoes the early New Orleans composer Jelly Roll Morton's riff structures and Latin rhythms on Black Hands Bejeweled. Its melody nods toward La Cucaracha. But while its concepts mirror Morton, its sound does not. Threadgill doesn't regurgitate his influences. He creates anew from time-tested materials. Here's an excerpt from Black Hands Bejeweled. The archaic-sounding trombone is Frank Lacey's. If the horn voicings and the wobbly intonation recall a collegiate halftime band, they emphasize that Threadgill's sources go beyond the jazz tradition to the music's origins in country blues, rural brass bands, Sousa marches, and vaudeville music. The staccato melody of Award the Squad Tet echoes the pyrotechnics of brass virtuosi like the Sousa band's Herbert Clark, as well as the angular melodies of Threadgill's fellow Chicagoans Anthony Braxton and Roscoe Mitchell. Thank you. Henry Threadgill's new album isn't entirely devoted to hard-charging music. My Rock, sung by Indian-born Aisha Putli, sounds partly inspired by the Afro-American art song she sang with Ornette Coleman on 1971's Science Fiction. For all of Threadgill's compositional sophistication, the sextet sound is increasingly accessible. This time out, it's almost melodic to a fault. I wish they'd spend a little less time repeating these catchy melodies and more time improvising on them. But if Threadgill has yet to make a perfect album with a sextet, he's never made a bad one, and this is one of their best.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Easily Slip Into Another World, Henry Threadgill's new album on RCA.
Open your eyes. See inside, be outside. All things appear.
This is Fresh Air. Bassist and composer Bill Lee is finding a new audience through the films of his son Spike Lee. Bill Lee composed and arranged the music for Spike Lee's first feature film, She's Gotta Have It. Nola's theme from the film was adapted from one of the several operas Bill Lee has written. Bill Lee was featured on bass. Bill Lee worked again with his son on Spike's new film, School Days. School Days is loosely based on Spike's experiences at Morehouse College, a black school in Atlanta, which is also Bill Lee's alma mater. On School Days, Bill Lee was the music supervisor and orchestra conductor. He also wrote some of the songs and composed the score. It's interesting, in School Days, the new movie, you don't play much or at all, really, on the soundtrack. Your role was largely composer and conductor. Wasn't it tempting to write more parts that would feature your own playing?
Not at all, because all these great musicians around, I just love the way they play. And I've been playing now for some 35, 40 years, and I get a great satisfaction out of that. But you have to move on to another level. And it required that I compose and conduct, and that was my proper position for School Days.
The movie's a comedy about conflicts between two different kinds of students, the students whose lives revolve around fraternities and sororities, and the students who are more political. In this case, some of the students want to get the university to divest its South African holdings. Were there any similar conflicts when you were in school between the more politicized students and the more party, fraternity, sorority?
Well, let me just stop you right there. Between the light skin and the black skin, that's the basic difference between groups that you would find, whether it's in college or out in the world. And I found that to be so when I was there, because I had a roommate who spent all day trying to make himself presentable for this people on Morehouse campus because he was dark-skinned and poor and had bad hair.
Now, were you dark-skinned?
Was I dark-skinned?
No, I should say that we're talking long distance. I'm not seeing you now as we speak. You're in New
York.
I'm in Philadelphia.
I'm considered dark-skinned.
So how did that affect you when you were in college?
Well, for me, I've been used to it all my life because my father used to always say he could pass for a white man as long as he didn't take his hat off and they would see his bad hair. And my mother was dark as the ace of spades. So we there were seven children of us, and we were all complexions.
So why was light skin considered better in some circles?
Oh, white is always right.
Now, you were talking about good hair and bad hair. Now, this is the subject of a song that you wrote for the movie called Straight and Nappy.
Yeah.
And the song is this, it's a big production number, and it's sung by the women in the movie, and there's basically two groups, and one group is the sorority women, and they have, quote, good hair, and their hair is straighter, and a lot of them dye their hair.
Mm-hmm.
And then the darker-skinned girls have the, quote, bad hair because it's natural and really curly.
Yeah.
So good and bad hair was a real big issue when you were in school, huh?
Yeah, it still is now.
What were you going for in the lyrics that you wrote for the song?
There's a poem I think I could recite that might cover some of it. And it's a poem from Baby Sweets, one of the operas that I wrote, one of the folk operas. And the poem goes like this. There's still such a thing as good and bad hair. Niggas just went round the corner and came right back. They ain't going nowhere. That poem was written, Baby Sweets was written during the era when afros were in.
Yeah, right, uh-huh.
And that's why I say this, went to the corner and came right back. They ain't going nowhere.
Talk about good and bad hair, whether you're dark or you're fair. So you can't go on and swear, see if I can, good and bad hair. Don't you wish you had hair like this, then the boys would give you a kiss. Talk about nothing but bliss, then you're gonna see what you miss.
If a flash should land on your head, then I'm sure he'd break all his legs. Cause you got so much grease up there, dear, is that a weave that you wear?
Well, you got cockabus standing all over your head. Well, you got sandy spurs.
You've written several operas, and one of your operas is about your experiences at Morehouse College, and that opera's called Colored College. What are some of the themes in that opera?
Well, there's two main characters in that opera called Ghetto and Country. And I'm country because I'm from way back in the backwoods of Snow Hill, Alabama. And one of my great friends and a roommate was from Cleveland. He was from the city, but ghetto.
Education must have been very important in your family. I understand that your grandfather founded a school.
Yeah, that's a long story. I wish I could tell you all about that. His name was William James Edwards. And if I had to point to anyone in our long line of descendants, he would have to be one of the gentlemen that I would focus on because he overcame great odds to go to Tuskegee, Alabama Institute. And at the time when Booker Washington was the president at the time, and he got to know him very well. And my grandfather did carry out the one of the main philosophies of Booker T. Washington that he taught through his speeches on Sunday evenings, to go back and uplift the people in your own community. Cast down your buckets where you are. And that's what my grandfather did, and he came back to Snow Hill and lift the people up out of the muck and mire.
Did you study music when you were in college?
Yes, I did. Some of the great musicians at Morehouse, there weren't many who majored in music, but Arthur Clark was one. He played in the Natchez Spiritual Orchestra that we recorded for school days.
Did you play much jazz when you were in college?
Yeah, we all did, and I tell you what, we were criticized for it, too. And we used to have to sneak around and sneak into the music buildings and play jazz, and if we were caught, we were run out of those classrooms.
Why?
Because they didn't want that kind of music to be played on the campus.
Because it was considered vulgar?
Low.
Low?
Mm-hmm.
Now, your parents must have been pretty upset after this long line of people who had dedicated themselves to education. you get out of school and become a jazz musician.
Now, my parents weren't.
I'll tell you that
my parents were happy because our father was, we went on the road when I was, we had a family band and my father took us on the road. And my mother didn't want us to go, though she was a great musician. She thought maybe they might have been taking us away from our education. But my father, he really wanted us to be a professional musician, so he taught all of us instruments. And we made a few appearances at his family band. So he was very happy when he found out that I was a musician.
Do you feel that you and your son, Spike Lee, have learned a lot about each other by working together on his movies?
Yeah, we've learned a lot. It's been a growing and sometimes painful experience, but nevertheless a great one. And I'd have to say I'm proud of him, and because he's taken a great step and is doing some great work.
Okay, well, listen, thank you. Thank you very much for talking with us.
You're quite welcome. I'm glad to be here.
Bill Lee's music is featured on the soundtrack recording of School Days. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, Terry, tonight we have a report on new patterns of drug use. Although accurate data is pretty hard to come by, there are studies that show that the use of illegal drugs is dropping, at least among white middle-class young people who seem to be responding to the anti-drug messages. But not dropping generally. You find now that drug use is moving back into the inner cities from the suburbs. Also, we visit Molesworth, England tonight. That town in England is near an installation of cruise missiles. And we talk to the people there and get their reaction, both from peace activists and others, on the removal of those missiles.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Like a catchy advertising jingle, the theme to a TV program can loop around and play back in your head all day, like it or not. Television critic David Bianculli has selected some of his favorite TV themes.
Don't panic. The Olympics are finally over, and I'm not going to spend any time talking about them. But I do want to talk about that opening theme music, which is so lush and powerful, it almost makes you expect greatness. I started thinking about that theme and how good it was whenever the Olympics got dull, which meant over the last 2 weeks I've thought about it for about 19 and a half hours. And by the time the Olympics were over, I had compiled a list of my favorite current TV themes, the ones that aren't just jingles or muzak, but which really give their series a special identity. One of them has the same effect as the Olympics theme, letting you know that something regal and special is on the way. That's the Masterpiece Theater theme, of course, which is a classical music composition by Moret. Most TV themes, though, are written specifically for the occasion, like this one, which immediately set its show apart from every other TV cop show. Great stuff. It let you know that Miami Vice was not going to be another Hawaii Five-O, but something new and loud and different. Another theme that advertises its show's hipness is Night Court, with a quirky intro that tells you, subliminally, to expect the unexpected. Conversely, the heartbeat intro and jazzy feel of St. Elsewhere's theme, like the theme to Hill Street Blues, prepares viewers for a free-form, fluid drama. I've saved my two favorite themes for last, and they're both relatively new ones. The Cosby Show theme is new this year because every year Bill Cosby hires somebody new to re-record and reinterpret it. This year's entry comes from Bobby McFerrin, who imitates a big band sound using only his voice and a multi-track recorder. Listen to this. It's terrific. Finally, there's the theme to a show that's been on Showtime cable for a year now, but which makes its broadcast premiere this weekend on the Fox network. The theme, like the show, is intentionally self-conscious, so much so that it's completely self-explanatory and deserves the last word. Here's the star of that show, introducing the theme that needs no introduction.
And, what do you say we get in the mood by running the opening theme? Great, and we'll be back.
Called me up and asked if I would write his theme song. I'm almost halfway finished. How do you like it so far? How do you like the theme to Gary Show? This is the theme to Gary Show, the opening theme to Gary Show. This is the music that you hear as you watch the credits. We're almost to the part of where I start to whistle. Then we'll watch it's Gary Shandling Show.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a bit of my favorite TV theme.
Zoom, 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 boom, 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 boom.
Here he comes, that mighty mouse, coming to vanquish the foe with a mighty blow. So don't be afraid anymore.
Here's a look at tomorrow's Fresh Air. Tomorrow, writer Mary Gordon talks about how her life is different from her fiction. Her books include The Company of Women, Final Payments, and Temporary Shelter. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will profile the career of soul great Percy Sledge. Ed says there was a lot more to Sledge than his hit When a Man Loves a Woman. And book critic John Leonard will review Rachel and Her Children, Jonathan Kozol's examination of the homeless in New York's welfare hotels. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Sue Spolin, Ruth Harold, Beth Wilcox, Gavin Morrison, and Kathy Anderson. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.